Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. I hadn't really thought about what I was going to say after that point.
You've got it there. You wrote it.
So when we talk about naval history, there are names that come up a lot. HMS Victory, yeah. HMS Warsight, SMS Scharnhorst, or maybe that's just me. But we're going to talk about a ship that is named after somewhere you've probably heard of. I'd be surprised if you hadn't. And I've got Ian Ballantyne, who is a journalist and historian who's written extensively about naval history and has filled a small chunk of my bookshelf and Kindle, including books Hunter Killers, The Deadly Trade, and Killing Bismarck, as well as several ship biographies, such as the aforementioned War, Spite and Victory. But he's here today to talk to us about one of his other books, HMS London. So, Ian, welcome to History Hack.
Thanks for inviting me on. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so the naval history community on Twitter is very small. So it's fair to say that we know each other from there as well.
I've seen you. You see me. Yeah, by the wonder of social media. Yeah, yeah. But it's interesting what you say about names. You know, some names are illustrious, very well known, and covered in battle honours. Like you know, I've written about War Spite and also Victory, two line of battle or battleships that are very, very famous. But also in a series I did, I've also written about HMS London and another famous battleship, HMS Rodney. But we're here to talk about London today. So I think as you're suggesting, you know, it's not a name perhaps that springs to the lips of, let's say, that small community on Twitter, but it's a very interesting one, a very interesting history, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And it goes right the way back, doesn't it? I mean, the first Londons are coming around in a naval conflict that I think only me and Charlie White talk about, which is the Anglo-Dutch Wars and Civil War and the Restoration.
Yeah, I mean, the first Londons, the first two were converted merchant ships, and they were basically provided to the King, King Charles I, as he was. And they were provided by the City of London, which was expected to fund these vessels to add to his fleet, which was more in the business of, I would say, privateering than it was and going overseas to search out riches in terms of spices and other things, and also trying to colonise various parts of the world than it was in being a formal fighting navy, although it was there to protect home waters against people like the infernal Dutch, who were possibly not many people understand this, but it was actually the Dutch that were our most formidable enemies in the 1600s. And although the Civil War came along and the London of that time, a 40-gun ship was one of 10 armed ships, those 10 armed ships that had been provided. And it was part of, obviously, the King's fleet. But when the time came to decide who to support during the Civil War, London and 11 other vessels out of 16 decided they would be for Parliament. And so they surrounded the other five ships and said, what are you going to do? You're going to be for Cromwell's mob. Are you going to support the King? And they supported the King, strangely enough. So, yeah, I mean, that's where it starts. But then it's, as you say, the Anglo-Dutch naval wars were incredible clashes at sea, what mainly in the Channel or the North Sea or off near London, off the coast of Eastern England. And so the early Londons, the two, in fact, the more than two, but the first three certainly were involved in that. And the first purpose built HMS London was a vessel that was actually constructed under the aegis of Oliver Cromwell. And so that idea of having a navy and investing in it really took root, I would say, under Cromwell, who formalized the navy as a fighting force. And it, as you'll probably know yourself, introduced fighting instructions and all sorts of other things, disciplinary acts. But one thing that was common to the king and the Lord Protector was, although they didn't invest in warships, they often didn't keep them very well. And between wars, they would not look after them. So dockyards fell into disrepair and so did ships. And London fell victim to that as well.
Yeah, I mean, Anglo-Dutch War, dockyards not being maintained and dockyard defences not being maintained and living in Gillingham.
Right.
We don't talk about that.
Yeah, well, you're talking about, that's a part of the world that's very much involved in it, wasn't it? In all this business back then against the Dutch. Mm. Yeah, but I mean, the third London was is actually an interesting ship because by 1665, when she was only 9 years old, they had decided that the Dutch were on the rise again and that they had to invest in the navy. And so the London was put into refit at Chatham to try and restore years of decay. And then in March of 1665, unfortunately, when they were putting on board guns to go off and fight the Dutch again, she blew up. And and that was probably due to ammunition handling, possibly the powder. That's probably the guilty party. But that killed 300 people instantly. And that was just off Southend-on-Sea, as it is today. And only 19 of the crew survived. So that was a massive blow. And so by this time, obviously, King Charles II was back, the Restoration Navy as it was then. And within a week of that London being blown up, an offer was made by the Lord Mayor and Alderman of London to build a new one. And the King was obviously delighted that the fourth London would be was going to come about pretty quickly because he needed ships now all of a sudden. So he called that one the Loyal London. But then when the money wasn't quite so forthcoming and they couldn't quite raise enough money, he got upset with them and took the Loyal bit away and she just became HMS London. That was an early London involved in a battle called the Battle of the Four-Day Fight. That was Loyal London was this next London, and which was quite an immense clash, and 4,500 dead or wounded and taken prisoner during the battle. And that vessel actually saw 81 years service, which I would say rivals Victory.
Oh, wow.
The length of time. Yeah, they kept rebuilding her. I mean, that's one of the things they did with wooden ships. They just they neglect them, rebuild them, send them out to war. They get damaged. They come back. They neglect them in the dockyard, and then they repair them and send them out again. So that's how she lasted 81 years, and that was the last of the pre shall we say pre revolutionary wars and Napoleonic wars vessels to you know wooden wall fighting vessels to actually be in service.
From memory, we did do, I think we've done a podcast on the Third London Explosion. I'll have to go back through our back catalogue. I believe we have done one on that one. I don't think I was on that one, but I do remember it being done. I think, again, that was Charlie because it was Stuart Navy.
Yeah. One of the things I did for the new paperback, I'm going to do a book, bit of book PR here, but one of the things I did for the new paperback of HMS London, because I wrote the book originally in the early 2000s, and it was published in 2003. But when we were in lockdown, during that cursed pandemic, I said to Pen and Sword Books, it's worth updating the HMS London book because there's going to be a new HMS London, which will be an anti-submarine frigate in the 2030s. And also the turn in our history from the end of the Cold War back to confrontation with Russia and also a rising China. I thought that it was quite fascinating for me because the London of the end of the Cold War was one that I went to see aboard. And it was quite fascinating to think that that vessel which is now a Romanian warship, was decommissioned from the Royal Navy in the late 90s and then bought by the Romanians, is now facing the Russians, as is the Royal Navy, in an aggressive sense. So the end of the Cold War, which we'll come to later, which the last HMS London played a role in, that's all come full circle. So I said we ought to do a book that gives it a different intro, and then some reflections at the end on the way the new London will be back in a new Cold War and a confrontation with China. But also I wanted to update other elements of the book. And so one of the things I did was do an appendix on the London that blew up off Southend-on-Sea, because I got in touch with the perhaps you had them on your podcast, I don't know, the archaeologist divers that were going down there.
Yeah, I'm rapidly trying to Google who we had. I remember.
Well, I talked to a guy called Steve Ellis, and he and his team from about 15 years ago started diving on HMS London, the one that's off Southend, and trying to recover artifacts, because there's going to be a museum in Southend-on-Sea. That was the plan. And so he and his team went down there, brought all this stuff up. And but the most dangerous thing they discovered, the most interesting thing they discovered, was a World War II German sea mine, which had its reckoned had been dropped off Chatham. And you'll have to forgive me, I've been to Chatham, but my geography is not brilliant, but it was dropped off Chatham and somehow, or dropped in the wrong place, and ended up in the wreck of Oliver Cromwell's HMS London. And so when Steve and his comrades were down there looking around in the silt and the mud, you know, they found this parachute mine. And so they had been working for ages on this and didn't notice it. But once they found it, they called in the Royal Navy, and they sent a team of explosive ordnance disposal experts. And fortunately, they got rid of it before it blew up, you know, and killed somebody or destroyed what was left of the wreck. So that was a close call that actually happened shortly before, if my memory serves me correct, it's all in the book, shortly before the pandemic. So I don't know if you discussed that, but that was quite an interesting turn of events.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go back and listen to the old episode. Yeah. It's been quite some time. Yeah. And it was with David Davis.
Right.
I haven't got the date or the thing. I'll send you the link.
But it's interesting to think that, you know, that belatedly, you know, we think, as you said earlier, about talking about names, we think about Victory and other ships and not the London. But actually the London's artifacts, the treasures that that wreck, you know, off Southend is yielding for this museum will actually be quite astonishing. And it would have been a pity if it had been blown up by a sea mine. But there you go. We managed to avoid that. But the London that we talked about there that had 81 years service came through, you know, the Anglo-Dutch Naval Wars and actually survived until 1747, which is quite extraordinary. Was the last of those Nelsonic Navy Londons. And the next one was originally a 90-gun ship and then a 98-gun ship built at Chatham, actually alongside HMS Victory, and authorised for build in 1758. So built alongside Victory in the same year of Nelson's birth. And then that vessel's story spanned quite a bit of the Revolutionary Wars, the War of Independence, the American War of Independence, first of all, the Revolutionary Wars, and the what we call the Napoleonic Wars. So that's the next one. That's the. I try to keep track of all the numbers of these ships. So the fifth London.
Because she goes from Chatham to the Chesapeake and has.
Not
directly, but she ends up at the Battle of the Chesapeake, which has unfortunate repercussions for one of my heroes, General Lord Cornwallis.
Right. And you're big into the Siege of Yorktown and things like that, are you? Or?
Kind of. I went to Cornwallis Secondary School.
Right.
And then I've ended up living completely by coincidence. I now live on Cornwallis Avenue.
That's coincidence. So you're telling me.
To be honest, it was the first flat that came up when I had to move out. So.
And do you think that was a good sign for for you for the future. I must have that flat. It's got called what is
it? Yeah, I think it was Young Synchronicity. But
yeah,
the Battle of the Chesapeake is a massive problem for the Royal Navy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's strange. London, HMS London, the 98 gunship, obviously got the battle honour, Chesapeake. But it wasn't that Battle of Chesapeake, the one that's on the Battle Honour Board. The one you're talking about was the later one. So there were two. And so, yeah, you're right. London in 1780 was the flagship of Rear Admiral Thomas Graves, who was appointed the commander of the North American Station. And, you know, as you know well, but maybe I'll just give a few details on it. There was, at the time, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, because you're probably a greater expert than I am, but the British land forces were split into two armies. One was based around New York under Henry Clinton, and the other in Virginia under your great hero, Cornwallis. And C was the link. Well, maybe not your hero, but a fascinating character. C was the vital link, as it is so often in this period. It happened in the Peninsular War as well, when the Royal Navy, aside from fighting the French or the Spanish or whoever at sea, does a kind of logistical link, taking troops and supplies and preventing the enemy from getting troops and supplies, and in this case, siege guns, into the Chesapeake to help the American rebels and French forces there besieging Yorktown. Yeah. So basically, what was happening was that the Royal Navy, with its North America fleet, was trying to stop the French from reinforcing the siege forces at Yorktown, who had the Cornwallis' troops bottled up. So they were supposed to dominate the Chesapeake Bay and stop the French being resupplied, etc. And so there was a battle in March 1781, and that's the one that provides the battle honour that the London, HMS London, is proud of. And so there were seven French ships that were carrying a couple of thousand troops that they were going to land to reinforce the American rebels. But Graves and his vessels managed to stop that happening, and the French withdrew to Newport. So they weren't going to give up. So they reinforced their fleet. They brought up ships from the Caribbean. They got ready. They had siege guns. They had troops. So they tried again. And again, the British under Graves tried to stop them. But he made, in this second battle of Chesapeake, he made the error of hanging around and being a bit too perfectionist about making a line of battle. And he thought the French were just going to line up, as they did so often in those years, until people like Samuel Hood and Rodney, Admiral Rodney and Nelson came along and decided they weren't going to stand for this gentlemanly passing of two lines of wooden wall line of battleships. So he hung around thinking he was going to have one of those gentlemanly battles and everything would be settled. And in fact, he took too long. So when they eventually clashed with the French, the two fleets made a V-shape, and the French and the enemy, the British enemy, the French, were able to concentrate more firepower at the head of their line. And so the London 10th in line of the British side had the guns knocked out and 20 casualties. And the damage wasn't too great to the British, and the French withdrew. And then the British went away and made the error of, I mean, you could correct me if I'm wrong here, but it's in the book. But I mean, they withdrew from the bay. They had a council of war, and then they went back to New York to get repairs, etc. And in the meantime, the French got in, just to sum up, there's a better account in the book, got in with the troops, the reinforcements, with the guns, the siege guns, and other supplies, etc., and basically defeated the British at Yorktown. So by the time the London and Graves and the fleet came back, all was silent. So is that a fairly potted summary of it, you think? Fairly easy one?
Yeah. Because I know Cornwallis was constantly writing to Clinton saying, and where is the Navy? When are you sending reinforcements? When are we getting out of here? And Clinton kept saying, yeah, we're working on it.
Yeah, we're working on it.
Yeah. And then the Royal Navy turned up and everything, and the French had gone because Cornwallis had to surrender.
Yeah, I mean, it's I think people look back at the major successes of the Royal Navy in the Wooden Wall, the Age of Fighting Sail, and there are many, and normally, and most of the time, would have the upper hand or the edge, but it did suffer reverses, defeats, and cock-ups. And that was definitely a cock-up. And I mean, you could call London the ship that lost America. It's probably going too far, because she was Graves' flagship. But I mean, I think basically, I mean, by then Britain was, you know, exhausted with it all and realizing that it was not going to win. And so I think it was just one more problem. And I've said this in the book, just one more problem in that long conflict. And perhaps people didn't think that that battle on the 5th of September, 1781, let's just mention that date. That's the second Battle of Chesapeake, would have those consequences, I guess. So, but it did.
That and the Royal Navy were also blockading Gibraltar or defending Gibraltar.
Yeah.
And blockading Holland because we had the Fourth Anglo-Dutch War.
So. Yes, exactly. And that's the other thing. Before London went off to the North America station, she went out part of a fleet trying to find the French and Spanish, the combined French, Franco-Spanish combined fleet. And as you say, at the time, Gibraltar was under siege. And they were actually off Plymouth, had anchored off Plymouth, and were about to go ashore in Plymouth, you know, and get, and Devonport being the main dockyard and naval base there, and take Devonport and say, well, look, you've got Gibraltar and we've got Plymouth and Devonport, so what are you going to do about it? Or, as it was called then, Devonport Dock. Yeah. And the only thing that stopped them, because the defences weren't too great in Devonport Dock and Plymouth, they were two separate towns at that time. And if they'd gone ashore, they probably would have managed it. Whether or not they would have stayed there is another thing. But they were defeated by disease and lack of supplies. So they eventually left and went to look for the British off the off Cornwall or something like that. But the British didn't find them, and they didn't find the British. So, I mean, yeah, that's another one of those episodes that perhaps doesn't get a lot of attention. But that was before before Graves took the ships to North America.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So, but it's interesting that way before the Second Battle of Chesapeake, and it's interesting, you mentioned that bit about Gibraltar, Chris, but in 1779, in August, after she left Chatham, London was part of a fleet that was sent to try and find a combined fleet of Spanish and French ships, and failed to in the Western Approaches. But in fact, they were actually off Plymouth at the time, which is not very well defended. And the Spanish and the French fleet dropped anchor and was going to send ashore an invasion force and take Devonport Dock, where the dockyard was, and Plymouth as well, Plymouth Town, the harbour there. But they failed to do that because of disease and lack of supplies. And so they went off again and went out to try and find the British in the South at Approaches, but it was terrible weather and they didn't. So that was 1779, London was the flagship of Graves. But anyway, that's a digression.
But after the War of Independence, she does have a role in the Napoleonic War and comes up in quite a few of the major battles. She was at Copenhagen, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, London was the flagship of the Royal Navy fleet that was sent to the Baltic with second in command was somebody called Nelson. And he was sent to the Baltic. I don't know, he was just a minor officer at the time. And but he had the frustrating experience after his great, you know, and illustrious exploits in the Mediterranean of being subordinated to this rather sort of elderly, not that old, but, you know, 64-year-old, not by today's standards, 64-year-old admiral called Sir Hyde Parker, who was described by somebody as kindly, fussy, stout, rubicund, and very rich. And he looked more like a yeoman farmer than a naval officer. And his main problem was he couldn't take a decision. And so he had this fleet gathered and in English waters. And Nelson was a fire eater and wanted to get on with going up to the Baltic and taking out the Danish, Swedish and Russian fleets, because they were cooperating with Napoleon and it looked like they might make a move against England to help him invade and attack England, to keep it simple. The League of Armed Neutrality was part of it as well. And it was all about supplies of hemp and wood that the Royal Navy needed to keep going, et cetera, et cetera. And Britain was very much dependent upon trade with the Baltic. But, you know, Nelson being a fire eater who'd had an astonishing victory at the Battle of the Nile and, you know, other exploits, you know, the Battle of Cape St. Vincent as well, was not very happy about being subordinated to this jolly and not very dynamic and indecisive Admiral Hyde Parker, who had his flag. This is where I come back to HMS London. He had his flag in HMS London, the 98-gun HMS London. So that eventually this guy was motivated partly by people like Nelson and other officers complaining he was taking too long hanging around in English waters and more involved with his social life than getting on with sorting out the Danes, first of all. So they went off to attack Copenhagen with a fleet, and London stood off with Hyde Parker aboard and watched as Nelson took charge, basically, and went in to the shallow waters and locked horns with the Danish Navy, which was quite an impressive force at that time. And also, never a great idea, but he tried it, bombarded shore batteries in, you know, fortifications. And Nelson looked like he might be losing the battle and in trouble. So, and this is where we come to the famous bit, which some of your listeners obviously won't know about. And so there was this famous signal sent to Nelson saying that basically you may disengage if you wish, or, you know, disengage the battle. This was by the Admiral in London. And Nelson did that bit where he just basically allegedly put his telescope to his blind eye and said, and there's more detail in the book, but, you know, I don't see the signal. I can't see that damn signal, to paraphrase it.
Yeah.
So he carried on with the battle and won, and then went across to see Hyde Parker later and presented this victory to him. And Hyde Parker said, well, actually, I was just giving you the option. You know, if you needed to, you were in trouble, old boy. You know, and I'm sort of boiling it down there. But I mean, and he soon was, you know, appointed somewhere else, and Nelson took over. So that's a very famous Nelson turning a blind eye, you know, a Nelsonic eye. I think that is used maybe to this day as a way of saying that, you know, commanders in navies or wherever sometimes would ignore orders, and that's where it comes from. So that was a notable exploit, and that London actually was more, I would say, more in action during smaller battles with French warships during her career than with in fleet actions, to be honest with you, apart from obviously playing a role as a flagship. Yeah, and so for that London, although flagship at various notable events, you know, Chesapeake and Copenhagen, it was the smaller actions in pursuit of the enemy, the sort of classic thing that you read about in Patrick O'Brien's series about Jack Aubrey. And one of those was when London, in October 1782, in company with a 74-gun ship, the Torbay, and a sloop called HMS Badger, chased the 74-gun French ship, Sibylle, and a frigate called Scipion in the Caribbean, or San Domingo. And it was a running fight that went on for hours and hours from the early part of the day right into the night. And London sort of hung on tenaciously and yawed as she pursued Scipion to present a broadside and attacked the French ship with all her firepower. But, and this is the thing I wanted to mention, because I wouldn't want people to think that the HMS London of the Napoleonic Wars didn't see a lot of action or suffer at all. But Scipion managed to rake London. And in the night. And that killed 100 men. So, as you know, that amount of, you know, Scipion managed a broadside right the way through the weak stern of London. You know, the carnage would have been absolutely unbearable and terrible, catastrophic. So that was one bloody fight in 1784. But then she had another action against the Marengo in 1806, which was off the Canaries, when the Marengo, 74-gun ship, was coming back from commerce raiding in the Indian Ocean in company with another ship, the Belle Poole, 40 guns. And they thought they'd come across a convoy that they would pounce on. But in fact, it was HMS London, along with the 80-gun Foudroyant and a 38-gun frigate, the Amazon. And so and there were five more British warships coming up. So the French, sort of to their misfortune, bit off more than they could chew. And that was quite an amazing running fight. And it was the battle started at 3 a.m. in the morning, and it just carried on. And in the end, the Amazon chased down the Belle Poole, and the Marengo was surrendered. And in that earlier fight with the Scipion, in fact, the Scipion was ran out of powder after raking London, and then was chased the following day and tried to find shelter in a bay in a Caribbean island and ran aground, and that was the end of her. So those sort of actions for that London, that those two actions were more the sort of pulverizing Jack Aubrey kind of story for that ship.
Anyone who's seen me on Twitter knows that I'm constantly going on about, and I don't like this word, but pre-dreadnought battleships. And we get another, we get a modern HM. I'm going to say modern HMS London, which is actually the lead ship of her class in the late Victorian period. And they go into the First World War, and everyone goes on about how pre-dreadnoughts are obsolete, and oh, they're not going to do it. But actually, pre-dreadnoughts do a hell of a lot of fighting. And HMS, in fact, more fighting than dreadnoughts do. There, I've said it.
You're right. Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely.
But, yeah, and our London actually has quite an eventful career in the First World War, doesn't she?
Yeah, I mean, this was the eighth London. You know, there's some dispute about how many Londons there are. I mean, some say 13, some say 12. The next one is going to be the 12th one. So this one was the eighth one, in my book, anyway. Yeah, I mean, as you say, you know, it was incredible, isn't it, that they do get maligned and relegated, don't they, to the boring, you know, they didn't do anything thing. And the eighth was, as you say, lead vessel for class, subclass. Because, I mean, I looked up a figure, which I'm sure you know, between 1892 and 1908, 51 so-called pre-dreadnoughts were built for the Royal Navy. And so London was, the lead ship of a subclass of three with Bulwark and Venerable. And, I mean, and when you think of the fact that with Dreadnought herself coming along in 1906, the ship that supposedly made the all these other vessels, these battleships, obsolete, and then led to another fleet, what should we call them? The superstars that people like to talk about most, the super dreadnoughts and the dreadnoughts themselves. We also had all these other vessels, and as you say, they did a lot. I mean, London, not as heavily armed, obviously, as the dreadnoughts and the super dreadnoughts. But, you know, 12-inch guns, but loads of 6-inch and loads of other vessels, which made them, as you suggested, very useful for all manner of roles. And they did a lot of good stuff. And, I mean, initially, in World War One, and it's interesting to me, and I'm going to digress just for a second here, what makes me laugh, or not laugh, but I think you'll find quite interesting, is that the pre-Dreadnought London, this allegedly old Victorian Edwardian-type battleship, just before World War One, was one of a few pre-dreadnoughts that undertook trials with aircraft flying from the tops of turrets or forecastles. And London did that just before the First World War. So in a way, although Dreadnought made London obsolete in many ways, London then took part in the early trials for naval aviation, which would lead to carriers, which would in turn make battleships of the super dreadnought and dreadnought class obsolete. So she, in essence, started the process of ending the ones that tried that replaced her and have gained all the headlines. But as you say, they did a lot, and London was in the Channel Fleet to begin with, which was either at Sheerness or down at Portland, and their job was to basically one of the jobs was if the German high seas fleet came south, was to sacrifice themselves in some sort of mad attempt to stop them. And so they did a lot of exercising, and sometimes too much. And there was a famous incident on New Year's Day 1915, when London was in company with other battleships, pre-dreadnoughts of the Channel Fleet, and U-24 came along and sank the Formidable, which was actually sailing in.
Yeah.
This was off off Dorset, and so that was a big shock to them. And of course, an even bigger shock, or an earlier shock at the end of 1914, was the blowing up of HMS Bulwark, and that was a thing as well during World War I, wasn't it? People's ammunition blowing up, ships' ammunition. Yeah.
They're all buried across the road from me.
Are they? What, from the Bulwark?
Yeah, well, I've got I'm pointing out the window. No one can see this, but I live opposite Woodlands Cemetery. And they've got all the Bulwark, what they could find. All buried there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that happened on the 26th of November, and as was quite typical at the time, 26th of November 1914, and as was quite typical at the time, spies and saboteurs were suspected, and it wasn't the case.
Yeah.
It was, one of the key players, if not the key player I've got in the book, which gave amazing insights into life at sea in a pre-dreadnought in action, was a midshipman, Charles Drake, who was assigned to London and went there at, as soon as war broke out, and stayed with London for years. And he gives an entry where he says that 26th of November, in his midshipman's journal, he says that 8 a.m. HMS Bulwark blew up, being completely destroyed by the explosion. When the catastrophe occurred, I was reading a signal exercise, I think he means book, on the port boat deck and had my back turned to the Bulwark, who was our next astern, so right behind the London. And he says, I experienced a slight shock coupled with a blast of hot air, and on turning saw a vast flame as high as the main truck, around which thick smoke was forming. And he could see debris in the air, and then there was more explosions. And he said later, having gone out to pick up the dead in a small boat from the water, that... And he was a witness at the inquiry as well that was held aboard HMS London, that they might have kept the finding secret, but he thought, he confessed that he thought, it wasn't saboteurs, and it was probably negligence as against enemy agents. And that would be somebody tossing a cigarette down an ammunition hoist or being otherwise careless. But having survived or seen that, and then Dodge being sunk by a U-boat off Dorset, London, went to the Dardanelles, hardworking vessel sent there. And that was a part of the war that claimed quite a few pre-dreadnoughts sunk by U-boats. But others were claimed by mines or damaged or sunk by mines. And the French were there as well, of course, with their equivalents. London was expected to go on bombardment runs down the Dardanelles to try and help clear away the guns, the Turkish guns that were, along with mines, preventing the Allies from getting through to Constantinople and taking Turkey out of the war by bombarding or capturing Constantinople. And that then would free Russia to receive reinforcements and supplies, but also export stuff as well, and keep Russia's war going against the Germans. And that was very much in the Allied favour, because they wanted to break the stalemate on the Western Front. And they thought if they got through and took Russia out of the war, then that would perhaps help divert the Germans. I'm simplifying it. And so because I think people don't quite understand what Gallipoli was all about, do they? Or the Dardanelles, it's all a bit mysterious to them, isn't it?
Yeah, everyone gets sort of gets hooked up on like Anzac Cove and everything, but they don't. Yeah, the whole reason for us being there, which was that Churchill hadn't learned anything from history, because the Napoleonic Wars they tried it and it went badly. But if they'd knocked Turkey out of the war, the British would have got the oil from Mesopotamia.
Right.
Turkey armies that were holding the Russians down in the Caucasus would no longer be there, and the Russians could then all concentrate on the main front. It was a massive, massive endeavour. And to quote Darkest Hour, if it actually worked, it would have been a serious operation.
And I mean, they didn't. I mean, at that time, when we think about amphibious landings now, and there's amphibious ships, landing ships that can disgorge troops in landing craft, and also armored fight, you know, amphibious armored fighting vehicles, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, assault carriers, that's the modern Navy. But this was early days, pre all that. And so London actually was one of the vessels that landed Australians at Anzac Cove. And they used their own boats, their own small boats, with the troops packed into them in late April 1915. And you know, Midshipman Drake and others actually saw this happening, and they did hope they'd get an element of surprise when they went ashore, but they didn't. And as soon as the enemy saw them, they opened fire with machine guns and rifles. And then, come the daylight, the artillery started in. And so that became quite a desperate fight for a toehold there. And London stood offshore and did her best with her own guns. But the thing that was remarkable for its, I would say, incompetence, but lack of foresight, was the care of the casualties, you know. And so Midshipman Dre is being sent, and other midshipmen and other young officers are being sent in their boats amid the shrapnel and the bullets to evacuate Australians, and of course all the way along, because we mustn't forget the New Zealanders were there, the British, the Newfoundland troops, the French, all of these massive landings. But, you know, obviously we just talk about Anzac Cove, and he was absolutely horrified by the fact that they had very few hospital ships, which when they were full would then go back to Alexandria. Not many of them would come back, and there were lots of casualties being treated aboard. Again, another role for the pre-dreadnoughts, with not much medical care for them aboard the pre-dreadnoughts and other vessels. And so that was something that he said was one of the biggest scandals. And I think the incredible thing about when you do research, as I'm sure you're aware, and you find eyewitness accounts, and I've got plenty of those in the book, is you get it changes your perspective from something that's a cold or an academic study of a disaster or a tactical or whatever it is problem. And then you get the worm's eye view, the midshipman, the junior officer, the junior rating, who says, you know, who's actually going in there in this instance to get casualties off the beach at Anzac Cove as the Australians are pushed back against the sea. And he said the question of accommodating the wounded became more pressing. Transports were hurriedly turned into hospital ships, and the London itself took in 79 serious cases, in addition to our own casualties from the boats, from the small boats who were going in to get the wounded. And he said he expresses his anger at the conditions. The most damning thing he said that the boatloads were transported from the beach, and they had to go and take the casualties to vessels that were already full of casualties. And he said that it was one of the big carefully concealed scandals of the Gallipoli campaign was that. But one of the most remarkable or one of those strange ironies of war is that he actually went aboard a hospital ship with his casualties. And the nurses there invited him to have some breakfast. And so he was able to sit in a vantage point, probably in a mess or on the upper deck, having breakfast, while he watched HMS London being shelled by the Turks. And the shell spouts were going up around his own ship, which was then got underway. And you could see officers and sailors running in frantically along the deck. And they just managed to avoid getting hit by some of these shells. So I think it was when you get the perspective of a lad as he was watching things from different perspectives that I think you get to convey the horror of war and also the fine detail.
Absolutely. It's as I was reading the book, We both do the same thing, because I write from the sailor's perspective as well, because, like you said, it nothing gives you a more a ship is a ship. It's, you know, it's made of its keel. You've got your guns, you've got your armor. It's a ship. But what makes a ship? God, I sound like Captain Jack Sparrow. But what makes a ship for me is the crew and the crew's experiences and what the crew go through. And so talking about the 18th of March or the Gallipoli campaign, or even I've got one for the sinking of HMS Goliath, and it was of a young sailor on board. It was like the whole experience of being woken up in the middle of the night and shit, oh crap, we're sinking. Of course, not many people survived that, so it gives you such a really interesting, like he's describing, as the ship's rolling over, you could hear all the crockery smashing against the wall, and it's just amazing. Yeah,
absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. And you know, that's those things. I mean, there was one of the other pre-dreadnoughts there, and I've written another book called The Deadly Trade, which has all this U-boats attacking pre-dreadnoughts. But one of the remarkable accounts I found was from an Australian soldier who was on the beach. This was obviously sometime later on the beach, watching because they were seeing the Navy offshore as their guarantor, their insurance, and then they were watching as these pre-dreadnoughts were sunk and keeled over, just like you've just described, and the feeling of despair when the warships had to be withdrawn back to a safe harbour was quite profound. And
that was Majestic, I believe. I think that was Majestic.
I'm trying to remember detail in another book now. But yeah, no, that was they were incredible episodes as well. Yeah.
Quickly moving on before.
Yes, no, digressing.
It's good. I'm enjoying it. I don't get to talk naval history. My kids look at me and go, "Oh, Dad, not again."
I know. They tolerate us, don't they, talking about naval history. But we realise we soon have to move on. Yeah.
My middle son's quite into it at the moment, but the other two just glare at me.
Ian, this has been awesome. It's so good to talk to, like we said, it's so good to talk to another naval historian. But it's so good, in fact, that we've gone on far too long. We're going to have to come back for a part two in a few weeks where we can talk about more HMS London shenanigans going into war, World War II and beyond.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.